You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. Hello, everyone. Welcome to part two of our conversation about the Kahuku community's ongoing struggle for energy justice. In our last episode, Jessica Dos Santos, Sunny Unga, and Dr. Tavita Ka'ili gave us the rundown on the AES Napuamakani Wind Power Project. They talked about why their community opposed this project and the many, many ways they tried to intervene in the decision-making and planning and permitting process before finally banding together and putting their bodies on the line to try to stop the project. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, you should definitely go back and catch up, because their story is a really clear and powerful example of the kinds of procedural injustices that make up our energy landscape. When we talk about procedural injustice, we're talking about the ways that decision-making structures and processes around energy policy tend to disempower the very communities that are most impacted by that energy policy. And the Kahuku experience definitely exposes a lot of that. Now, in this episode, we're jumping right back into the conversation, sort of digging into the moment when the struggle got super ku'e and Kahuku engaged in more than a month-long blockade to try to stop the construction of the Napuamakani wind turbines. In this episode, you'll hear a lot about what we can think of as distributive injustice, where certain communities, typically poor and working class BIPOC communities, are forced to bear a disproportionate amount of the burdens of energy production without sharing in the benefits. But the best part of this conversation is that you don't just get to hear what the Kahuku community was fighting against. You'll also get to hear about their vision, and it's a really, really good one. They talk a little about energy sovereignty and how empowering communities and working from the ground up instead of the top down can help not only transition us from fossil fuels to renewable energy, but also transform us from an extractive capitalist society to one in which we have a richer relationship with aina and with the places that we call home. Plus, Sunny, Jessica, and Tavita share some wise words of advice on how you can begin to transform your very own relationship to our energy system. Okay, part two, here we go. Do any of you have a standout memory from that month-long stretch of time, or even from the struggle before that? For me, I was only there one night, and it was well into the struggle. And I was shocked that after that many nights, there were still probably like 200 people there at 9 p.m. until I think past 3 o'clock. So first of all, I'm like, how can these people keep showing up? But then for me, like just off of that one night, I witnessed something that I will never forget, which was, Jessica, like you said, the police really being tools for a private corporation. Because at the end of the night, there was only one person left chained to block the road. And it was coming up to the point where they would have to open up the freeways. So if they couldn't move her, then they couldn't move the equipment. And so I saw the police just huddle around her so that the transportation equipment, which is mind-blowingly huge, could squeeze past. And I was shocked that the police would put their own bodies at risk, because it looked really scary and it looked dangerous for them. So they were literally putting their bodies in harm's way to essentially make sure that a corporation got their job done. So I'm wondering if there are any memories like that that stand out for you folks that you wouldn't mind sharing.
Well, for me, I think the coming together of the many community, because this was a time we also saw Hawaiians and Samoans and Tongans and, you know, other ethnic group that would come together. And if you were Kalailoa, you would hear singing in the different languages. Often it was Hawaiian, like most of the time you'd hear singing in Hawaiian, but you were also hear singing in Tongan or Samoan. Or even other languages where people of different ethnic groups were all coming together. And I really like that, because it sort of kind of create not only the solidarity between Kahuku and Waianae and Namakuli and other people throughout the islands, but also different ethnic groups were also coming together to sort of stand together to protect their community, which, you know, really something that we saw that was happening at Mauna Kea, but we were also doing it here in Kahuku. We had on our tent flags of the different groups that were represented, that were there. That was also really amazing for us to be part of all of that. Coming back to the police and the police as a private security for the corporation, you know, we got to the point that we learned from the Mauna Kea folks that we had to communicate in a secure way. Many of us had to not only just text in the regular, but we had to download a specific program that we use, Mauna Kea also use, in order for us to keep our communications secure as far as like planning for, you know, what we were doing. And so we had to go, you know, we've learned a lot just from that. And also just working together with other group and forming allies was important to us. And we're taking many of the lessons that we learned from there to our ongoing fight with other issues, such as the radar and so forth. But I would say that would be the memories for me. Even when I was arrested, when I was in my jail cell, you know, I was there with Hawaiian and a Samoan, and I'm Tongan. So there's like three of us who were from different backgrounds, all in the same cell and waiting to be processed. You know, we came out, we had our Hawaiian flag, we were holding it up. We've been up all night and we didn't come out of jail until 6 a.m. I would add that also is like one of the ones that stand out to me.
I think the thing that stood out to me, and this is really hard for me to talk about because on this occasion, I really was emotionally distraught. Like, keep in mind, we hadn't been sleeping for, you know, months already. Just a regular, you know, day. We were hanging out at the tent in Kahuku, and there was only a handful of us because people had to go home and take care of their families. And it was during the daytime, and we had set up our kula o kahuku, where children had been going on a daily basis to learn oli and to learn the chants and practice and to learn, you know, Hawaiian culture. We're really using that as an opportunity to educate. AES had devised the plan to bring their trucks down to the site, and they actually brought down these very extremely large, intimidating pieces of equipment and trucks. And we looked and we're like, whoa, what's going on? And the people who had been in that tent on the road stood up, and the trucks literally drove directly up to them as if they would be willing to run them over. And there were several trucks that actually sped right next to our tent and tried to basically surround our tent. And our kia'i stood there, and I was just like, oh my gosh, something bad could have happened. The kids could have been there. Like, family members could have been there when these trucks were speeding past. And then you see the big bulldozer and the big dump truck. They just surrounded us. And it was just the most traumatizing experience, where this corporation was using these equipments in a military style tactic to threaten us and to intimidate us. And it could have been very bad. People could have gotten hurt. But that night, just the community came out in full force. And it's so crazy, like how beautiful, it's not crazy, but just beautiful about how our community came together. And by the end of that night, they were doing the electric slide under the tent and playing music, and people were trying to liven up the atmosphere, and everyone came and brought their cots, and with these big large trucks still there, you know, and they're just putting all their chairs and their cots in like a big circle that just basically hugged our tent that was there on the road. And they stayed all night, and everyone just came together to protect the camp and protect the kia'i that were there. And oh, that was one of the biggest memories that I had. And I was an emotional wreck on my live feed and realized, like, wow, like, you really have to be strong. Not everybody is strong enough to handle these types of large, stressful, traumatizing events. And we made all the mistakes, you know, like throughout the whole fight, like we made so many mistakes and so many things we now can look back and say, wow, like we learned a lot in a very short amount of time.
You know, when I look back, I can't help but feel so emotional. It was traumatizing. You know, you're seeing hundreds of cops to protect corporate, you know, corporate interest. And we have our kupunas, you know, we have our moms, we have our aunties and uncles, you know, getting arrested. And despite the injustices that all of us in the Ki'ais experienced, and despite seeing that in action and seeing, you know, how, you know, they gave leniency to, you know, to AES and transporting their equipment and, you know, things like that. And while you're in the midst of police brutality, you know, it's really hard to keep kapu aloha. And I'm amazed they were. And I'm amazed with how they were able to keep themselves with kapu aloha. And when there was times when it was extremely difficult and when there was people who were, you know, about to lose it, people will come to their aid and say, hey, you know, and they would stay with them and they would help them to calm down and breathe, just like Jessica helped me when I was looking at all the injustices happening. You know, I was just kind of like, oh my goodness, this is not right. This is not pono. This is not okay. And Jessica came and helped me. You know, we saw that time and time again. Even if you don't know the person standing right next to you, they were mindful of what was going on and enough to stand next to them, put their hands on their shoulder, and to stand in solidarity and help each other maintain kapu aloha. And I think that was one of the most beautiful things that came out of this ugly, traumatizing event. We've learned and we built relationships and friendship out of this experience that we've had.
It's so nice hearing for every really ugly part of that experience. It feels like you also walked away with these really powerful moments, and there's beauty in the struggle, even though you hope that you don't have to struggle. One question I have is, after all of this that you learned, one theme of this season of this podcast is about how energy justice is really hard to get people super excited about because the whole decision-making process around energy is really alienating. Already we're talking, I'm hearing things like PUC, contested case hearing, power purchasing agreement. These are things that people who care about their communities might not be familiar with. So it takes a lot of work and a lot of courage to get involved in a process that's not designed to really engage the people who are most impacted. So my question is, do you have advice for people who want to get involved, ways that they can start or avenues that you feel like are most effective? Because many other communities are going to face issues like this in the future.
No, for me, local ownership of energy is probably one of the most important aspects of this, because we've learned through our fight that when somebody outside, corporation that's not even from Hawaii, dictating how our energy should be used, they don't have our best interest in mind. All they care about is making profit, and they're not here to see the everyday consequences of the decisions that they make in their corporate boardroom, some other places. So I would say for people, you know, advocate for your community, your local community, the people who are indigenous to that area, and then the local resident to have ownership and a say in the way that energy is produced within that area. This is sort of where we're moving, and we're beginning to think about others that are doing something similar, like what they're doing in Molokai and others, to think about what can we do as a community to own our energy. Just to say a few things, like from culturally perspective, you know, the wind here in Kahuku has a name. The name is Ahamanu, and that means the gathering of birds. You know, big corporation doesn't really care about the name of the wind here in Kahuku, and they don't really care that that is significant and that there are wind deity that are connected to that particular wind, and then also our Opeapea. I mean, these are all things that are important to us because we live right here and that they are part of our everyday lives. And I would say people to begin to think about these things, not as resources, but to see them as relations or relatives, wind and sun or solar, all of these elements of natures from, you know, an indigenous Hawaiian or from a Pacific Islander's viewpoint. You know, these are our relations. These are not resources to be extracted and exploited. These are our relations, and we should find ways to malama them. And I would say that would be the way to think and move forward.
Yeah, that's not an easy question to answer, because even after all these years, I feel like we're still scratching the surface to understand how the system works. But what I'm hearing from Dr. Ka'ili is that we can imagine different systems if we change our thinking and if we change our language. to really value the akua, that which gives us life, and to ask ourselves, do we really need to keep doing the same thing we've been doing? Or can we just have the courage to say, you know what? Maybe we don't need to produce this much energy. What are we producing this energy for? The 10 million tourists that come here to these islands that desecrate our land, tear apart our infrastructure. So really just have the courage to imagine a different way of being and a different way of living that doesn't have to be continuing this extractive capitalism, this top-down approach, this corporate profit-driven model that we're all living in. Look at the examples that we have with the kupuna, the ancestors of this very special place called Hawaii, right? Like, they understood systems thinking. So education, educating ourselves and educating other people and encouraging other people to really take that education and share it to really huli the system and change the entire way that we think about energy, water, resources, land, that is going to solve climate change, not these like quick fixes and, you know, tunnel vision policy enactments. Really, it really needs to come within all of us to really ask us, you know, what do we really need in life? What is the most important thing in life? Do we really need to consume the way we're consuming? Starts with that. And then we can achieve energy justice.
That's so powerful. Just, you're right. Like, what are we producing this energy for?
For me, you know, it could be very overwhelming to figure out where to start. Oftentimes, I think we're left feeling like, even if I say something, will it make a difference? So it's hard for a lot of us to get involved and be active. And, you know, for the most part, I was kind of in that situation. But moving to Kahuku kind of opened my eyes up a little bit more as to what's going on. And it just started going to a meeting. And then, you know, at that city council hearing, I started to learn how it worked over there. And then it led me to go to a BLNR meeting, which led me to learn about how it works at the BLNR, which led me to the PUC, and then which led me to the BOE, and actually, you know, putting in a request for a rule change, administrative rule, to, in hopes to, you know, better, you know, the transparency in the processes with the school and then the projects that happen nearby. And so, and then that led me to the ledge, you know, getting involved with legislative work and seeing how bills get enacted or how bills die and how you can testify. And so, you know, it wasn't like I knew everything all at once. It was just gradual. And I think through that process, I was able to learn and grow personally and, you know, feel the importance of advocacy work and really doing something to voice our opinions and our concerns. Because, you know, I do feel that there's a strong disconnect with our policymakers or people who are, you know, making decisions, because oftentimes they don't realize the impacts of their decisions, or often they're driven by corporate interests or developers or whoever is supporting them financially for, you know, their campaign and things like that. So I think when our community comes together and voices our opinions, it becomes stronger. You know, just last week, the public hearing at the planning commissions about the setback, they could have just decided to accept the DPP's recommendation of 1,500 feet, which we as a community felt that was totally inadequate, you know, to protect our residents and our children from these industrial scale turbines. But instead of just accepting and saying, okay, we're going to accept DPP's recommendation, they paused, you know, nobody could write out, say what they wanted to do. And after a pause, they said, you know what, I think that we need to learn more about this issue and discuss this further. There's been a lot of community input and testimonies that they felt that they could not ignore. So I walked away from that meeting feeling encouraged, you know, feeling that our voice in one shape or form made a small little difference. And I know sometimes that's so hard to feel because there's so many moving parts and so many ongoing issues in many different areas. And we often feel, you know, the communities, the vulnerable communities often feel that their voices aren't being heard. But I feel empowered knowing that I'm doing my best as a mom trying to leave a better future for my keiki. And I think it just starts one step at a time. And in that process, you'll make friendships, getting to know Jessica, Tavita, and many other people who helped. And you create alliances, you know, and that's a beautiful thing. So my recommendation is just to start where you're at, you know. If there's an issue that you feel drawn to, then dive in and testify. And then one thing will lead to another. And you know, you don't know. You might be, you know, the next activist, you know, fighting for a certain justice for your community.
I feel like that's such an empowering piece of advice, because it's like no one's going to be an expert. They made it so you're not going to be an expert, but you become an expert along the way because you care about your community and your community has your back. I think that's really important for us all to hear. And the part about making friends, because that always helps. Okay, so just a few more questions. Where are you folks at in the fight right now? And I guess related to that, are there ways that we can support you through that?
Okay, so I'll talk about the contested case with the Hawaii Supreme Court. It's going to be online so people can join us. And basically, this case, we are challenging the habitat conservation plan. So when, you know, somebody is going to build something or develop and it's going to impact the environment, they are required to create a habitat conservation plan to care for the things that they're going to be destroying. In this case, is the Opeapea. And in our case, we're basically saying that their habitat conservation plan, the Napuamakani, is not sufficient. It's not adequate. It's not going to create any more live bats. We're hoping that the people can tune in and be part of the process. And we're trying to raise awareness so that people know about this particular case, which is just one of the other cases that we're involved in.
People want to get involved with the Supreme Court case. They can also make donations to Keep the North Shore Country. And our fearless attorneys, Lance and Bianca and other attorneys, have been just so giving and supporting of our community's efforts, and we really need to balama them back. And so make sure that if you feel compelled to help, definitely donate. And it'd be wonderful if thousands of people logged in to that live stream of the court case. You know, really speaks volumes. If everyone shows up and listens in, it'll show the court that the people are watching, the people are listening. We're not going to sit back anymore and just be in the background. We're going to step up and say, listen to us. One of the many things I love about Sunny is that she just asks questions. She no scared. She call up the office and she asks the people. You know, a lot of us, we get intimidated by government, but we forget that the government works for us. They are supposed to be for us, and we should hold them accountable. So if we don't know, just call and ask. That's the beauty of what Sunny does. She's fearless, and she just, okay, I'm going to call and I'm going to ask. And if I can't get that answer, I'm going to call somebody else and I'm going to ask. Right? That's the process of learning is really messy and time consuming. And it's so hard to learn all these things, but we can learn, and we can share what we learn with other groups. Like Sunny said, make alliances. There's so many people who have been in the fight and in the struggle for so long that we can all lean on each other. We all, us people, need to connect with each other and teach each other and share the information that we have so that we can confront our so-called leaders to, you know, really listen to us.
And I would also like to highlight another amazing organization, Life of the Land. Life of the Land is an organization that fights for energy justice, environmental justice. And this organization has intervened in so many of the PUC hearings, and it's helped our community. And actually, they have another court that's waiting a hearing date at the circuit court. And this is in regards to the setback regulation and how DPP provided the developers an exemption to place them, you know, even closer than what was allotted, you know, by law. So that's being also challenged in court. And Life of the Land is an organization that's heading that with Lance Collins and Bianca Isaki, our lawyers that are also with Keep the North Shore Country. You can follow that. And then also the public hearing that I mentioned with the Planning Commission. So there's going to be, you know, soon we'll probably hear what's going to happen about the setback regulation. And we have an opportunity to say our current setback regulation, which is height of the turbine, is inadequate. And we need to increase that setback to really protect our community and residences from corporate greed. They really don't have the community's best interests at heart. And it, the only way we could protect, you know, our community and our safety and our health is by increasing setbacks. So tune into that. And Jessica has made an amazing website that you can go to, you know, to follow what's going on and to see how you can get involved. And that's enoughturbineshawaii.org. And you'll find more information in that website as well.
Got it. I want to ask two quick follow-up questions. I wanted to first ask if Dr. Ka'ili, you could explain a little bit about the cultural significance of the Ōpeʻopeʻa. And then I also wanted to ask maybe if Sunny, you mentioned the power purchasing agreement. So if each of you could give a little short definition or explanation.
Yeah, so the Ōpeʻopeʻa is considered to be an ancestor in the Hawaiian Kumulipo, which is the Hawaiian cosmogonic chant of the creation chant. The Ōpeʻopeʻa actually comes before people. And so in that process, they are considered to be an ancestors to Native Hawaiians. They are also, you know, associated, or Ōpeʻopeʻa in particular is associated with the Akua Kanaloa. Kanaloa is one of the principal Hawaiian deity, which usually associated with the ocean. But this is one of Kanaloa's kinolau, or manifestation, which is the Ōpeʻopeʻa.
So the power purchase agreement is pretty much the power purchase agreement. So PUC will grant, in this particular case, granted AES a power purchase agreement to provide energy. In Hawaii, in the state of Hawaii, they, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jessica, I'm trying to recall from a year and a half ago, but basically you normally go through a competitive bidding process. So you say, hey, you know, there's this project and we need so X amount of energy, and who can produce that? And so, you know, solar farms or wind farms or companies or developers would put in their bid. But in this particular case, HECO and AES or Napumakani had already kind of said, oh, we'll do this. And then they presented it. And rather than going through the competitive bidding process, Napumakani was chosen. But if you forego the competitive bidding process, then you have to strictly adhere to all the deadlines that you need to have before your construction and operation of your project, which means that you have to have all the permits in place and all the permits for land use in place in order for your project to move forward. So anyways, that's the power purchase agreement. And that was the whole thing with the PUC, that they failed to adhere to all the deadlines that they were required to have, and they didn't have the proper permits in place. And so then we see again, oh, there was leniency. And because normally when you forego that bidding process, you have to do it strictly. Basically, the motion for relief was saying, based on these, you know, violations, please void the power purchase agreement. So I don't know if that's what you were asking for, but that's kind of the background, if I'm recalling it correctly. Do you remember, Jessica, if I said anything, or Tabitha?
I'm going to try with my limited knowledge, I'm going to try and kind of put it in terms of how I see the power purchase agreement. I think this agreement is setting the price for how much the power utility will pay the corporation for the energy that they produce for the state. And so this agreement sets the price. That price determines how much profit the corporation will make, as well as affect the price that consumers will pay for the energy that's being produced. So that was another big problem with the power purchase agreement, is that the power being produced is very expensive. It's not going to save the ratepayers money. it actually, you know, gets passed, all of these costs, all of these agreements gets passed down eventually to the ratepayers. Meanwhile, AES and HECO ensure through these power purchase agreements their profitability.
Right. And then mind you, they approved a price that was 7 times the going rate at that time. You know, that defeats the whole purpose of going through the competitive bidding process. So it was against the public good. That was, yeah, that was another issue that they brought up.
Okay. Thank you. That's super helpful. Okay. So last question is, in your wildest dreams, what does energy sovereignty look like to you for Hawaii and for Kahuku?
HECO is dismantled. No more HECO. And we have small scale, community-based microgrids that can stay online should natural disasters hit in, you know, certain parts of the islands. We can sustain ourselves. You know, all the communities would have their own resilience hubs, like how Haula Community Association is creating in the Haula community, where we have, they have renewable energy and food production and emergency preparedness resources. You know, just prepared. We're, you know, communities are prepared to withstand the sea level rise and the increased hurricanes that are already upon us, and producing energy, you know, for ourselves, for the benefit of ourselves, having control over the prices so that people are not paying these exorbitant costs to a corporation that has absolutely no problem with making profits while people are not able to even pay their electricity bills during a pandemic.
Yeah. The only thing I want to add to that is, you know, our energy consumption. We have to find ways to reduce our energy consumption. And that is related to our economy and perhaps moving away from a tourist industry to find a way that our energy consumption is sustainable for our island. I mean, you know, this is part of a long history of colonialism and settler colonialism that comes into a place and sort of kind of erase the people and their history and their practices. So going as far as local ownership of energy, but also at the same time, you know, we become more aware of our consumption of energy, because, you know, right now we're just over consuming energy to the point that we're building infrastructure that is destroying the you know, the environment.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that, because, yeah, aside from, oh, make sure you turn off the lights when you leave the room, we don't ask that question, and that's such a big one. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand the history behind HECO and how that interplays and affects the whole system that is in place today. And, you know, just to piggyback on what was already said, you know, energy sovereignty means community-led, community-driven. The community gets to decide how it happens in their community. You know, energy sovereignty, I believe it should include the communities to be the active participants in leading how things should be decided within their community. And I think it's, you know, building a system from the bottom-top approach, right? Starting from the people, you have to incorporate all these different areas, food sustainability, like resilience, like indigenous rights and like our ecosystem. Having energy sovereignty would have all of those things in harmony and working together to better our community, to benefit the community, and to build a sustainable, resilient future for our future generations.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. I just have to say, that was an incredible conversation. I learned so much, and I'm so seriously grateful that you guys joined us. Is there any last things either any of you want to add?
No, thank you so much for having us on here and for amplifying our voices. We really appreciate it so much.
Of course, you guys are so knowledgeable. And
yeah, thank you so much, Dina.
My pleasure, for real.
Yeah, and thank you so much for this, you know, platform to really get this message across. And I, you know, I think a lot of times, you know, we get this bad reputation. Oftentimes we're considered NIMBYs, but I think what all of us really want to emphasize and echo is that we're not against moving towards a clean energy economy. Like, we realize that, you know, there's devastating effects of climate change. And our community is literally going through that right now with all the flooding that happened in our communities and our roads falling into the ocean. You know, we feel the impacts of it. But what we do believe in is that these renewable energy projects must be done right with equity, justice in mind, and with the community. And that's what we firmly believe in.
That's so important too. You're on the front lines of climate impacts as well. Thank you for that. Okay, thank you so much again. And I hope that we get to talk more.
Okay, that wraps up our conversation, and I just want to send a huge thank you to Sunny Unga, Jessica Dos Santos, and Dr. Tevita Kaili for joining us. I don't know about you guys, but I've been deep in my pandemic feels lately, dealing with a lot of mixed and heavy emotions with the tourists starting to flood back in, and it seeming like life is kind of going back to normal, but mostly in all of the worst ways. I've been feeling pretty hopeless, and I left this conversation feeling so grateful that we have such strong and dedicated and knowledgeable leaders in our community. I just feel like they articulated their vision so clearly, and I saw it, and I want that. You know, it's like we could have that if we want it badly enough. And they're really putting in the work and giving it everything they can to make it a reality. So mahalo to our guests and to all of the Kia'i out there in Kahuku and beyond who are fighting for energy sovereignty and energy justice. Thanks for listening. Stay rooted.